Good morning and welcome to Launch. We're broadcasting live from Atlanta, Georgia. I'm your host, Ron Reardon. I'm joined in the studio by a producer, Lee Cantor. Good morning, Lee. How are you doing today?
I am doing great. We're in the heart of summer now for me. I've been getting outside, enjoying it, except for the rain. But yep. Other than that, feeling good about the summer. How about you?
Yeah.
Big plans, traveling?
I'll be traveling to Las Vegas here this weekend. My wife's got a conference there that she's preparing a big speech for.
So. And you get to tag along?
That's right.
Just for fun this time.
Yeah, she's been upgraded to business class, but I
not you?
Not me yet, okay? So we'll talk about that. Well, Lee, you know, on Launch, we feature inventors, innovators, entrepreneurs, and companies that assist all those folks, you know, providing our listeners with the opportunity to learn from both the successes and the failures of launching an idea and the journey that follows. This morning, we're going to be featuring Carla Hunter and Jack Lander. They're co-authors of two books. One is called How to Create the Perfect Sell Sheet. The other one is Producing Your Invention on Your Own. They've got another third book that's on its way. But before we get started, Lee, could you thank today's sponsor?
Our sponsor today is Patents & More. Patents & More, protecting your innovation and connecting you to the resources you need for success.
That's right. Well, today my guest is our Jack Lander and Carla Hunter. Let me introduce Jack first. You know, Jack's a seasoned inventor. He's got 12 patents. He's always working on some more. His most commercially successful patents are assigned to U.S. Surgical Corporation. He's been the president of the United Inventors Association, vice president of the Yankee Invention Exposition. He's been a featured columnist in Inventor's Digest for the past 12 years, writing the Lander Zone. He published a sterling book called How to Finance Your Invention or Great Idea. I've got two copies of that. And also the All You I Need Is Money. And he's produced and edited and contributed three chapters to the United Inventors Association's six-point master plan. And he previously owned and ran a manufacturing shop called Short Run Productions. You might be interested in that one, Short Run Productions.
Yeah, there you go.
And Carla Hunter is an inventor. She's got 10 U.S. patents. They're all related to 3G wireless network applications. She's an attorney. She focuses her practice on issues relating to inventing and small businesses. The new book that they have coming out is going to be called Marketing Your Invention, Market Your Invention. It's coming out about September 1st. And besides writing, Carla and Jack also teach online seminars and provide inventors, you know, new product evaluations, and they mentor inventors. So in their spare time, they're going to be marketing a new product of their own called Trez Out. Welcome, Carla and Jack. How are you doing?
Good morning, Ron.
Okay. Jack, let's start with you. You've been mentoring inventors for many years. I think even your website's called inventor-mentor.com. What do you think separates successful inventors from unsuccessful inventors?
Oh, boy. Well, Carla, I'll answer that question. No, I'm just kidding. I think, first of all, personality. Inventors, let me say first of all, before I get into that, let me say that these are the extremes that I'm talking about, the extreme inventor and the extreme entrepreneur. But the radical or extreme inventor, his personality is such that he probably doesn't like marketing, shies away from it, and doesn't do the preliminary, doesn't take the preliminary steps to evaluate the invention and see if it's really marketable before plunging ahead. So that's one thing. And that's probably the basic thing. Another thing is that the inventor, the true inventor or extreme inventor, he stumbles on ideas rather than looking for what the market needs. The most successful inventors spend a lot of time thinking about what the market needs and inventing to the need rather than just stumbling across an idea as most of us do. You know, I'm guilty of it myself, but I think those are the two main things.
It's the personality and checking out the market.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, because I know that most inventors, you know, they're really good at inventing, but they're really bad at marketing. Okay, that's for sure. And sometimes they'll say, you know, this is really cool, it solves a problem I've got, but they don't do the research like you're saying to find out, well, there's only 10 other people in the whole world that, you know, would want to pay for this problem to be solved.
Right.
And that's not going to be a big enough market for them to make any money.
Right.
That's true. Well, Carla, let's start with how personality type can affect success?
Yes. You know, personality type, like Jack was just talking about, the inventors really can partner up with people or get mentors to learn how to actually take their products from their mind to the marketplace. And I think we have a common friend, Orville Crane, whose story of taking the clever cutter to market really demonstrates the power of, if you recognize your own personality type, you know, you can really succeed instead of letting that overcome you. So, for example, with the clever cutter, Orville Crane is a salesman, and he was working one day going into Walgreens, and the Walgreens manager shared a new product idea he'd been thinking about for several years. And as you probably know, that happens a lot with inventors. We think about things for longer, you know, several years sometimes before we actually get around to doing something about it. So the Walgreens manager he'd recognized an important problem, and he understood the requirements for a safer box cutter to use in the retailer stockroom. But getting his idea to market just wasn't something he knew what to do, and he didn't feel comfortable tackling it. So it was really a critical step that he took when he understood that his own personality, you know, really was stopping him from moving forward on that, and he sought out partners that helped make a difference.
Now, how does somebody do that? How do you know what a good partner would be?
Well, a good partner, first of all, should have different capabilities than you, right? So if you're the creative, the inventor that is coming up with the ideas, you need to have someone who's going to help you either market or manufacture. And additionally, just besides the abilities people bring, right, the personality also needs to be, if they're a salesman, you know, you need to make sure that you're looking for someone who really is able to go out and sell. Don't just look for someone who calls themselves a salesman, right? Make sure they really are an extrovert and they really are out there selling. And one other thing about personality, and it has to do with if you personally want to have work-life balance, you want to make sure that the people that you get together with want to have work-life balance. If you want to work 24, you know, hours a day, 7 days a week, you want to make sure your partners do, too.
That's correct.
Let me add something to that, too, Carla. One of the things that I see a lot in mentoring inventors is that two inventors, because they have common interests and because they're probably friends, decide to go into business together, and it's a disaster.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's really rare that any kind of partnership works. I mean, if you can get one working, it's a major miracle. Well, you know, we had Orville on the show last year, and my understanding is that there's actually three people involved. There's the inventor that, you know, actually invented the device but didn't know really about getting it manufactured or getting it sold. You know, Orville was the salesman, and then Orville, I believe, knew somebody that there locally that could actually manufacture it. And so it was the three of them, you know, having complementary skills that really made that thing work.
Exactly. And I think they're a great success story.
Now, when you get into those kind of relationships, you have one person who has the idea. What kind of revenue share do these kind of people typically figure out?
Or
are you just contracting and buying their skills?
You can do it either way. One thing we suggest, though, is if you find someone that you think you want to partner with where they're putting in their sweat equity or their time, you know, providing their skill for a piece of the business, you want to make sure that you're really clear on what their role is and what is expected of them. Another problem that we see with inventors is they are so happy that someone is willing to help them that they'll give away 50% of their company and, you know, without any real clear agreement on what they're going to get for that 50%. So, you know, we don't recommend that people give away their company without clear guidelines and expectations about what the other person needs to provide.
I see the opposite, too. I see sometimes where the inventor thinks his idea is so great that he wants 90% and turns over the marketing responsibility to somebody and for 10% or tries anyway. And, you know, that's not fair. Ideas are so plentiful. There are ideas around, a good inventor will have three before breakfast. And ideas are not until you do something with them, develop them into a product and protect them with a patent or whatever, until you arrive at that point, you just got an idea. It isn't worth 90%.
Yeah, I've seen that happen a lot with inventors, Carl and Jack, is what I call control issues, is that the inventor wants to always maintain control, than 50%, like you said, up to 90%. And that usually ends in failure because no investor, no partners are going to want to be part of that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, is there such a thing, Jack, as a successful inventor's process?
I think so. I think that the process. There are some steps that every inventor, whether he's entrepreneurial or an extreme inventor, should take. The first thing is to. I think the first thing is to sit down and create what we call a sell sheet. Now that sounds like a strange first step, but if you will put down on paper the benefits that your ultimate customer will get from your product or your invention when it becomes a product, put those steps down. What are these benefits? Strongest benefit first. And what the problem is that most inventors think in terms of features. The features are the technical part of it. But the feature is of little value in the marketplace unless it creates a benefit. So you refocus from features to benefits. Get that down on paper in the form of a sell sheet, and start with that, and that will be your focus throughout the whole venture of development, which would include the design and drafting, 3D CAD drafting most of the time, prototyping. So that would be your development phase, and then you'd have the marketing phase, which would be deciding, which channel is going to be best for it, and proceed to develop the product, figure the manufacturing processes, and so on. So, yeah, those are some of the. I could spend an hour outlining that, but let's say very briefly, those are the steps that I think that. The successful inventor has to follow.
Yeah, and tied right in with that, Jack and Carla, is figuring out what's the perceived value of a typical customer for those benefits. Because if their perceived value is like, well, I'll pay a dollar for this, and if your manufacturing costs are $5, then you're in deep yogurt immediately.
Exactly, inventors. There's two ways to assign a price to a product. One is from the top down, which you've just covered, where you look at the perceived value. What does the customer think this thing is going to be worth? The other is from the bottom up, where you take your manufacturing cost and you multiply it by a factor like 5, which is usually a fairly safe factor. But if your manufacturing process was not selected carefully, and most inventors are not experts on manufacturing, they might come up with a price that's twice what the market is willing to pay.
Yeah, that's true. Well, one of the steps was determining if your product can make money before you get too far in development. A lot of people will say, well, how do I determine what those manufacturing costs are? Is there any way to use surrogates? What would be the process if you've got something that's never been done before? How would you figure out what the... in volume, what the manufacturing cost would be?
Well, there's one basic difficulty in trying to do that, because if you go out and start talking to vendors, first of all, you might select the wrong vendor. You might assume that this part should be machined rather than plastic injection molded. But let's say you have a pretty good gut feel about it being plastic injection molded, and you go out to the first molder, and the molder has a mold shop in China where they make their molds. but they don't discuss the possibilities of an aluminum mold because it just isn't something they do. An aluminum mold might end up costing a half or even less than a steel mold. And so you don't, you know, if they don't tell you this, how are you going to find it out? You've got to ask a lot of questions. You've got to ask one basic question of every vendor you talk to. And of course, I guess I should have said to begin with, you must go out and talk to vendors of these various processes. What the key question you ask is, after you discuss their way of making it, is if you were going to make a small quantity to begin with, how would you make it? You know, and the vendor may or may not know, because vendors have specialties and they concentrate on their own specialty. They may not know that there's a process below them that can make the exact same product, but make it at a very small tooling cost and a higher unit cost. So it's just a process of going out and learning, and I don't know of any other good way. I mean, there are some books on it. Brawla has a book on processes, but, you know, the best way is to go out and start talking to people.
Okay. Well, Carla, I understand that you were recently working with the founder and president of Brilliant Pet on a pet product for the inventors. Can you talk about his evaluation process?
Yes, this is a good example because someone, you know, was sharing the same concept about you have to be really smart about creating your products. Now, this particular company actually was the inventor of scoop-free litter boxes, which has been on the market, I don't know, probably about 6 years. They're really successful. And he just came out with a new toy called Frolic Cat, which was voted the number one new toy at the Pet Expo. And so he really, I think he's a great person to listen to. He was saying that, you know, when they put together an idea for a product, how do they decide, you know, should we go forward with this product or not? And one of the big factors, you know, one of the things that they do before they ever actually create a prototype is they go through what kind of features would this product, you know, have in it. And they work with their manufacturer, because they do have a manufacturer, to say, okay, now how much would this cost to make? And for each feature, you know, each additional part that they have to that product, they'll break each feature down, and they'll say, okay, if we want to add this feature, how much will it cost? The bottom line is that for each product, you know, for the product, you have to be able to mark that product up 5 times from the cost at a minimum. So if they talk to a buyer, so they're talking to a buyer and a manufacturer here. If they talk to the buyer and the buyer says, you know, I can sell it for $10, then, of course, they can't, you know, they have to make sure that that product can be made for 20% or one-fifth of that $10, so they have to be able to make it for $2. If they add a feature that costs 5 cents, they have to be able to mark that feature up to 25 cents. So that's the process they use.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds pretty straightforward.
I've come across inventors that had so many features in their invention that they couldn't sell it. By cutting back on the features and offering a more basic model, they got their price into the ballpark where they'd get customers.
Yeah, I think there's probably only one Swiss Army knife, right?
Right.
With all those different tools. Well, I understand that there's a story behind a man that was developing an automatic stirring spoon to use on top of your stove. Who wants to talk about that?
Yeah, that was Jim Richardson. Yeah, he worked with the inventor of that. He did all the development work, and they got it on the market. And I don't remember why it wasn't successful. I think it was priced right. I think there was just not enough response from people. They imagined they had, and I'm not absolutely sure of this, but I think they imagined they had a much bigger audience than they did.
Well, another problem was that the guy, he got investors. His product idea was such a cool idea. Can you imagine if you don't have to stand there and stir gravy or pudding or all those things that, you know, you have to stir constantly while they're cooking? And so he got investors, and the problem was that he stayed too long in the development process. He kept tweaking it and perfecting it. instead of, you know, at some point just saying, okay, go, right? So that's another problem we see with inventors is they want to create the perfect product. At some point, your product has to be good enough.
I think of my favorite business guru, Peter F. Drucker, who passed away a couple of years ago. Peter Drucker has a statement that I just love. He says, it's more important to do the right thing than to do things right.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Just think about that. It's more important to do the right thing than to do things right.
That's right. Yeah, I've heard that there's two kinds of salesmen. There's one that says, I'm not going to make any appointments until I get my sales presentation perfect. And then the other salesman says, I'd better work on my sales presentation for these five appointments I made for tomorrow. So, yeah, action is important, that's for sure. You know, when you talk about stirring, you know, things on the stove, I have a funny story on that. You know, my wife is from Mexico City, so Spanish is her first language, and she's English is her second. So she had me, you know, in charge of watching some beans that we're cooking, you know, one time many years ago. And so she sits there and she looks at me, and I'm sitting there staring at the beans, and she says, move the beans. And so I pick up the entire pot, and I'm like, where do you want me to move them to? And she's like, no, no, stir the beans. I want you to move the beans by stirring. I'm like, oh, okay. Because I was taking it literally. Where do you want me to move these beans, you know? But, you know, is there a best way for inventors to get their products to market? I mean, should they start with a big box like Home Depot?
Oh, God, no, no, no. First of all, the big chains don't want they won't take a chance on something that hasn't proven itself in the market already. You know, they're not in the speculation business. They want to know how many of these are already selling. Are the sales inclining? Who have you sold them to? And so, you know, the inventor might have that dream of going to the Home Depot or any of the big chains and starting up, but that isn't the way to do it. If most of our inventions are novel, I mean, that's the whole idea of an invention, right? And they belong in catalogs. The catalogs not only welcome novelty, they depend on it. Most catalogs, I mean, there are exceptions like L.L. Bean, a catalog that competes with retail stores, but most catalogs don't try to compete with the retail stores. They look for niche items that people who are browsing through their catalog will buy on impulse and that sort of thing. So catalogs are inventor friendly. They don't mind selling. They don't mind buying from you if you're a lone producer, whereas the chain stores want product lines. They don't want single product. The catalogs don't care if your production facility is your garage or your basement, or whether you've rented 4,000 square feet in one of those parks. You know, those industrial parks. So the inventor should start, if possible, always start with the catalog.
Now, are catalogs still popular in this day and age with everybody being online?
Yeah, they are. I mean, a lot of catalogs have got their website up too, and they're depending upon website sales as well as their printed copies. But printed copies are still going strong. Whether they have a future 20 years from now or not, I don't know. But right now, I would say don't worry about it.
Well, I know whenever my wife and I travel, she always pulls out the SkyMall catalog.
Right.
And she sits there, I want this, I want that, I want this. And I'm just like, well, I hope that, you know, since we can't make the phone call right now, that she'll forget about it by the time we land. So I know that that particular catalog, you know, since they've got a captive market with nothing else to do but to leaf through the catalog, that one's really successful.
Now, and that's not really for the inventor, the inexperienced inventor, because most of the items are very high priced, and they charge you a lot of money to get in there. I mean, you think of a catalog taking your product and not charging you anything, but the SkyMall guys, they get a lot of money to just let you in. So you're better off to start off with one of the 12,000 catalogs that's listed in the directory of mail order catalogs by Gray House Publishing.
And some of those don't charge you?
No, they don't. Well, some of them will have a nominal charge, like maybe $100 for a setup fee, setup fee to take your photo and write the copy and that sort of thing. But the charge is usually nominal. It's not thousands, you know, it's just $100 or $150.
Mm-hmm. Well, September 1st, your new book, Market Your Inventions, coming out. Tell us about that.
Carla, you want to say something about it?
Sure. Well, our new book is going to focus on marketing for the inventor, for the independent inventor, and we'll be helping them walk through successful steps to actually, you know, get their product on the market. Talking about things just like some of the things we've been talking about here today, how to, know how much to, we are going to talk about how much to spend for your product, you know, how to cost and price your product, because it matters in the marketing world based on what retail outlet you use, how much you have to market up. So we'll talk about that. We'll also be talking about how to actually get into catalogs and, you know, some of the good things about catalogs, like the fact that, you know, they're going to order a small amount to begin with. So, you know, that's a great way to get started and then build up to retail. We're also going to talk about how to do things online, you know, how you might go out and create a fan page for your product. We're going to tell you how to do that, or how to set up a website using WordPress. We're going to talk about that. So it's got a little bit of what to do and then how to do it.
Okay, that sounds real good, because, you know, a website to me is really critical in this day and age. If you don't have a website, people don't think you have a real business.
Absolutely. Right. And you know what happens with the inventor who's in catalogs? The inventor who's in catalogs and has his own good website, a lot of times the people will look in the catalog, they'll come across the idea in the catalog, and later they'll look it up on the Internet and buy it directly from you, and you make the full markup.
So it's kind of like a 1-2 step then.
Yeah, I mean, the catalog, of course, doesn't like that to happen, but it's a fact of how consumers buy things.
Another thing, you know, and actually we're going to teach people how to set up websites without paying for, you know, web developers to help them get started. I mean, once later on they can have a fancier site, but we can help them actually set it up by themselves for free.
So there's a way to set up a website for free, and they can actually sell their product out of that website?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and they have control over the content. As a matter of fact, it's really becoming very popular. The Wall Street Journal uses it. Inventor's Digest uses it. We use it.
Yeah.
And it's just there's some great platforms that you can use that you can actually blog. You can set up static pages with your product. And you can also let your customers start interacting, you know, give you some testimonials live, which are really important, you know, just by typing it in. They can type it in. You don't even have to enter it.
Yeah, it sounds like the barrier to entry to really launching a business is getting lower and lower.
Exactly.
And the inventor is on par with the corporation. I mean, when you have a website up there, whether you're a single person producing or 10,000 people producing, why? You have the same. You're on the same par.
Yeah, I think that was really a great thing to say too, Ron. Because, you know, people with technology, how it's improved so much, you can create a prototype, get one created for a couple $100s, right? That looks pretty real, if it's plastic, right?
That's right. Well, you know, I got my MBA several years ago, Carla, and so the only thing I remember from it is get a low barrier to entry. You know?
and this is really getting there. I mean, you can get your website up. You can get distribution going. You can use, you know, Twitter and Facebook to start talking, you know, build your network.
Yeah, get some buzz going, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. You know, you've already created your prototype. You can create a low volume, like Jack was saying. Use catalogs. There's just a lot of tips that successful inventors will use.
Okay.
And if you have a high barrier to entry, that is, if it's going to cost you, say, $30,000, $40,000 for an injection mold, then you can do what Orville did, enlist a strategic partner rather than a financial partner. A strategic partner is one who comes to you with resources other than money. And, you know, there are a lot of plastic injection molders who, especially since so much of the business has been going overseas, who would welcome a proprietary product, but they don't have, you know, they don't have the time or the wherewithal to conceive of the product. But you come to them with some interesting figures, let's say sales figures or market research figures, and you say, look, there's a waiting market for this product. I don't have the money to invest in the mold. You have the mold making facilities and the capability to produce a production run, and thereafter have the production business. So why don't we get together?
Yeah, that's really a smart way to go. Well, Carla and Jack, you two joined forces some time ago. What services does your company, Carla and Jack, provide for the inventor?
We do new product evaluations. So if people have ideas, we can look at it, give an opinion. We also go through and do teleseminars. We do on all kinds of parts about how to create your product and market your product and develop your product. We have books. And we also, because Jack understands manufacturing and design, we answer a lot of questions that, we can't exactly fit into a neat package.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I've always said that when it comes to inventing, the key phrase is it depends. There is no such thing as a real cookie cutter. Everyone's unique. You know, the industry is unique, the inventor is unique, the invention or the product, the benefits, they're all, it depends.
Exactly.
Yeah. And do you do trademarks and legal work also, Carla?
Yes. I'm also an attorney, and I do trademarks and I do different things for small businesses that have to do usually with around innovation.
Are you on a short list of attorneys that are inventors? Is that a big fraternity?
I don't think I know any attorneys who are inventors.
It's a club of one.
It's a really short list.
Yeah, that's like when I went in to take a class on how to pass the patent bar, the first statement that the teacher made at the beginning, he asked a question. He says, what kind of person becomes a patent attorney? And there's silence out there. And he says, the people that don't have the personality to do tax work.
And oh, my gosh.
So, a patent practitioner that actually has personality is really rare, okay? Well, Carla and Jack, this has been great. What's your website so that people can get in touch with you?
It's Carla, K-A-R-L-A, CarlaAndJack.com.
Okay, that's super. Well, thanks for being on our show today, Carla and Jack. Our listeners have gotten some great nuggets and learnings that they can use in their launch and in their journey. Thanks again.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
Okay, another great
show. Bye, Ron.
Okay.
Bye.
Another great show, Lee.
Special thanks to today's sponsor, Patents and More, your trusted guide through the innovation jungle.
And tune in each week at this same time to listen live or go to our website, thelaunchhour.businessradiox.com, to listen at your convenience. Until next week, I'm Ron Reardon and our producer, Lee Cantor, signing off another great session of Launch.